The Monologue.
Just ahead of the midterm elections, Twitter made an announcement that a lot of folks just kind of missed. But obviously, some media outlets picked it up. They've got a new fact-checking policy. A fact-checking policy that is supposed to pre-bunk some of the quote-unquote misinformation that might be going around online. They will proactively go after what they consider to be misinformation. Now, obviously, Twitter is not to be trusted when it comes to misinformation, certainly not by the standards that they had laid bare in front of us the last time, when we had to consider whether or not big tech was trying to influence an election. They decided to ban anyone from posting certain kinds of things connected to Hunter Biden and the laptop that we were told was Russian disinformation, when it turns out, no, it was not. Now, they posted earlier this morning on their blog that the company aims to enable healthy civic conversation on Twitter while ensuring people have the context they need to make informed decisions about content that they encounter. So what does that mean? They say they're going to begin heavy enforcement of their civic integrity policy, which is all about combating those misleading claims. They write, claims about how to participate in a civic process, like how to vote, misleading content intended to intimidate or dissuade people from participating in the election, and misleading claims intended to undermine public confidence in an election, including false information about the outcome of the election. That's the kind of content that they're going to go after. They say tweets that fall into that category might end up getting a flag with a little tab that says, hey, this post contains false information. And on top of that, it means some posts will not be able to be liked or shared, like retweeted. They're bringing back the pre-bunk, which was launched back in, I believe it was for the 2020 election, which was there to basically put banners of information in their timeline and their search bar when you're looking at certain topics so that they can ensure that the quote-unquote right kind of material gets in front of you. Now, it seems like on the surface you might say, or someone might say, not you because you're smarter than that, but some people might look at this and say, what's the big deal? Of course they want to get in the way of lies about voter integrity. Who determines what the lies are? Who determines it? Who determines what is a lie versus what is an opinion that someone has based on their own analysis? I see lots of bad takes online, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, anywhere else. I see a lot of bad takes in print. I hear a lot of bad takes on the air. But the fact of the matter is, that is their opinion. Stating opinion very easily gets flagged as misinformation. So someone's out there who says, hey, I've got some significant issues with mail-in voting. I personally have significant issues with mail-in voting in states that have not actually gone through with a years and years and years long process to ensure that it's safe. And so simply asking some of those questions, I think is fair, and calling out the process saying you don't trust it, I also think that's fair. Even if I may disagree with some of the content there or the opinions there or the analysis there, I think it is at least fair to ask those questions and make your voice heard. And so I'm deeply concerned about this decision to be active and proactive and aggressive in enforcing this policy. Again, the people who make the decisions come with a bias. And we saw that bias on full display during the last election. And I think it is beyond truth at this point. It should be gospel that big tech cannot be trusted on political issues. And by the way, I would hold that view if they were going after liberal analysis and liberal positions. I generally believe in more speech is better than less speech. No one's arguing that you shouldn't have a set of rules. But I am saying that when you put a whole bunch of 20-somethings in the Bay Area in charge of deciding what is or is not permissible because of an ideological position that they hold, I think that that's wrong. And I think it's an abuse of the process. Now, later on in this hour, in fact, at 5:30, we'll be talking with Devin Nunes. Devin Nunes is a former congressman, but also the guy who's the CEO of Truth Social, which I am on. Truth Social is the former president's current social media platform. I'm on it under Jason Rance if you want to follow me there. Now, in fairness, I'm everywhere. I'm on Getter. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. You can find me pretty easily. But I'm glad that they're now jumping into this space, because there I am less concerned about the liberal bias that could, in fact, dictate some of the rules of what it is you can and cannot see. And from my experiences using Truth Social, I've not witnessed them at all be overbroad in how they interpret some of their policies in order to take content down. I just haven't seen that. Now this.
The interview.
Significant news, an update from the Attorney General Merrick Garland saying he personally approved of the decision to seek that search warrant to go into the private residence at Mar-a-Lago for former President Donald Trump. Joining me on the line to discuss is our friend, Congressman Dan Newhouse. Welcome back to the show. This has got to be an interesting story for you to track, because on the one hand, you know, part of the issue that some voters had with you, not enough not to send you into the general, was your vote to impeach the president. But this seems to be completely separate in a potential abuse of power.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, Jason. You can be a supporter or not of President Trump and still be very, very concerned about what's happening here. You know, this move is unprecedented to go. The FBI going into a former president's home and with a warrant to pick up information that they've been apparently negotiating on back and forth to give back to the archives. I tell you what, the Department of Justice has a lot of explaining to do here. What we heard from Mr. Garland this morning was almost nothing, no information whatsoever. And I think the American people deserve much more.
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway was something that everyone kind of already knew, even though there was a rumor that said otherwise. Everyone knew he had to have personally approved this. There was no doubt that you're going to execute a search warrant on a former president at his home and not run this up the flagpole. So you're right. We obviously didn't learn all that much. He did say that they filed a motion to unseal this search warrant and the property receipt. It's my understanding, though, that more like putting the onus on the president's team to release this information. So what is it that you want answered at this point?
Well, you know, certainly there are a lot of concerns about the process that was used here. But I think we don't know their justification. And then that's what they're not shedding any light on whatsoever. And I think that that's what the American people need to hear. They need to hear what caused the Department of Justice to take this action. You know, it sounds, and you know, a lot of people are speculating and going on very little information. And to let people do that and spin and spin and spin for days on end, that is not healthy for our country. We need to have information. We need to have clarity. We need answers to some of the questions so that we can either, you know, we may not like the outcome, but we need to know the justification for the actions that they've taken.
If this is, in fact, tied to the January 6th investigation, and by the way, for those of you at home, I said this earlier, it is legal to put in place a search warrant for something that is not necessarily related to the main reason why you might actually want to do the search. That's how it works. If this is related to January 6th, would that change your view as far as the actions of the DOJ?
Well, I think that's the question that everybody has. What evidence or what caused the Department of Justice to go to a federal magistrate, get this warrant, and carry out this procedure? Everybody wants to know the justification for that. And that, you know, many people have said that justice we've got to follow no matter who gets caught up in this. We've got to serve the American people. This process is concerning to should be concerning to all Americans, no matter what, because of the lack of transparency here, and that's what's concerning to me. It's an unprecedented move with very little information, and that's why I'm calling on the Department of Justice to enlighten us, tell us what's going on.
In the minute that we have left, congratulations on getting to the general. There wasn't really a question as to whether or not you would make it. The question would be who you would face. You're going to face a Democrat in a conservative district, but is there concern that there might still be some lingering anger with your vote on impeachment from Republicans? Obviously, Lauren Culp was pushing that very hard.
Well, Jason, you know, the bottom line is I am the same conservative member of Congress now as I was a year and a half ago. I will continue to represent my district using my strong conservative principles. I'm communicating that to as many people as I possibly can get through to. Is there some anger still? I would say yes, probably so. But I think most people looking at the choice that they have in front of them now, whether it's a conservative Republican in a very conservative district or a very, very liberal Democrat.
Yeah.
I think that choice will be clear.
And as I've said on the show multiple times, I disagreed with your vote there, but to question whether or not you're a conservative is absurd. I don't hold that view with Jamie Herrera Butler. I think that there are reasonable criticisms of some of her positions, but not in this race. We've been talking with Congressman Dan Newhouse. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure.
Now this.
The monologue.
Our friend of the show, Seattle City Councilmember Sarah Nelson. She has a proposal that she is pursuing to make it a little bit easier and, frankly, cheaper for production companies to come to the city of Seattle to go ahead and film here, film your TV shows, film your movies. She introduced a bill establishing a Seattle Film Commission. And the goal of this would be to advise the politicians in charge on what can be done to best support the workers and the businesses in the city's film sector. So she's hoping that this will be enough to bring some big budget productions to the city.
It's bad enough to see Vancouver in movies and films that are supposed to be about Seattle. And it's even worse to see our creatives in small businesses moving to other cities with more film opportunities.
Yep. She's right on that, of course. So be a little bit more specific, Councilmember. What would this commission actually do?
Commissioners will advise the city in the development of initiatives that strengthen our regional film economy and attract out-of-state productions that generate living wage jobs and pour money into communities.
Now, that part to me is the most meaningful, right? I personally don't care if someone shoots in Vancouver and they pretend that it's Seattle. I don't care. I really don't care. It doesn't impact me whatsoever. And then anyone who says that bothers them are probably the same people who love Frasier. But when you have these kinds of productions locally, it does two things to our economy, both positive. It indirectly helps the economy by bringing a whole bunch of people here from outside of the city, outside of the state, traveling with the production company, and they spend their money locally. They spend their money locally on businesses, retail shops, any of the businesses that directly cater towards entertainment and production companies. They go into restaurants. They go into our hotels. They go into our coffee shops. And they are bringing with them the money, spending money, that they otherwise would not have spent. So all of this is just fairy dust when it comes to tax revenue. The other thing is they'll hire people who are local. And some of that will be very like low-level things like extras, stand-ins. But then also you'll get hired security. You'll get, again, like I said, those businesses that already operate in the entertainment world. That's good news for the economy. And when you start to shoot here, it begets more shooting here and more and more and more. Ironically, that's also how shooting, literal shooting, murdering in Seattle works. It begets more murdering, but we'll push that aside. And by the way, that actually gives me an idea. How many good zombie movies could be available here? And you pay just the fentanyl-addicted homeless people to just wander around as extras? There's probably a security concern, but you give them just like $20 for the day? Or an hour even, because you're going to have to pay per hour. I'm kidding. Well, there was that one movie that was shot here last year from HBO Max with Zoe Kravitz. I didn't see it. It's named, I think the name of the movie is just a woman's name. I never actually saw it. But, you know, it also brings a sense of excitement, I suppose, and traffic, which is annoying. I will say ultimately, you know, it's funny because this bill is already getting some criticism from some activists in the community. And they're like, hey, what you're going to do is just give them a whole bunch of tax breaks to bring their corporations here, their big budget dollar movies here. Oh, that's not fair. You're giving them to these rich production companies. Why would you give them a pass? It's going to cost us a lot of money just even to host them. It's absurd. I think at the end of the day, and I certainly agree that you shouldn't give them a 100% tax break, but you should try to lure them here. And maybe a way to do this in a more responsible way, that just to dip our toes in the water, because I don't want filming here 24/7, 7 days. Like I don't want that year round. Just because I do think it becomes a bigger hassle at that point. But if we can get X amount of production companies here a year or a quarter, just pick it where it won't have substantial impact on traffic, but it'll also bring in some money, again, the fairy dust, I'm all for it. Just dip your toes there. And maybe it will convince the Seattle City Council and the mayor's office to take care of the homeless situation a lot better, because they want to make sure that these production companies have some good first impressions of Seattle and don't really have to worry about whether or not a space they want to shoot in is going to be overrun by homeless people. So there's the added fairy dust on top of the fairy dust, which is maybe it'll clean up some of the homeless encampments.
The interview.
Well, we got some news today that impacts a lot of folks who drive in and out or around Seattle. Joining me in our booth is our friend Chris Sullivan from our sister station, Cairo News Radio. Hello.
Hello, Jason.
What was the news about the West Seattle Bridge?
That the long exile of the tribe formerly known as the West Seattleites is over.
Yay.
We've got the date for when the West Seattle Bridge is scheduled to reopen. It is September 18th. That's a Sunday. So after almost 2.5 years, that'll be the day that they're going to get the bridge back open after they had to close it because of the cracking concrete. So now we have a firm date for when things will somewhat maybe get back to normal for West Seattle.
When was it supposed to open?
Well, they had tried to get it open by June, by the end of June, July timeframe. They ran into significant delays because of the concrete workers strike, which, as we all know, hasn't really been resolved. Mm-hmm. But they decided to go back to work. But that cost them about 2 months. And that 2 months is almost directly correlated to where they are right now in getting this thing reopened. I'm sure there's some other smaller pieces that factored into that, certainly, but they were hoping for July, early July, but it didn't happen. And here we are now with the 18th of September.
And the thing is, the reason why we're talking about it is not just about West Seattle, because this was causing a whole lot of problems for everyone who was basically driving in that area on I-5.
Yeah, there was only one route, direct route out of West Seattle, and that was the Low Bridge, and that has been restricted to traffic for emergency vehicles, people heading to cancer treatments, things like that, buses, so much so that they put photo enforcement on the Low Bridge, which, by the way, will be going away the exact same day that they reopen. The Low Bridge will be back open to everybody. But you're right. I mean, people driving through the Duwamish Valley, people driving down through Burien, trying to find other ways to get around, putting more traffic on I-5, the drive into downtown, never used to be as backed up as it has been over the last couple of years. Well, once we got out of COVID and more people were driving again, there were a lot more people coming on south of the West Seattle Bridge that normally would have been maybe using the West Seattle Bridge. Now, this is going to be a panacea. If, 100,000 people a day use that thing during its height. We'll see what the hybrid model does for them or whatnot, but bus service will be back and commuters will be back in some way, shape, or form. So when this opens, I'm expecting it probably to be as busy as it was before, unless the work from home really takes off in West Seattle.
Why'd they make the announcement today?
Because they said about when we talked to them last that they would give us like a 30-day advanced warning of, okay, here's what we know. It was all about trying to be as open and transparent, they said, as possible. Give us 30 days to get used to this so you can plan ahead and like, okay, maybe you can tell your boss, yeah, I can maybe come back to work a couple days a week.
Oh, they'll find another excuse.
Or something. Well, or something like that is like, hey, your bus service is returning to normal on this day. So that's why they did it. They gave us like a 30-day countdown so people could kind of get ready. And again, there are still some things that could get in the way that could push this. I mean, you never know what can happen on a major construction project. I mean, we've had worker shortages. We've had supply chain issues. You never know what can happen.
Find more cracks.
Well, the big thing about that has to happen now is the load testing, where they actually put a live load weight on the bridge to make sure that it can handle buses and cars and trucks again. So what they've done or what they will do is they're going to put double dump trucks out there. One in static testing, they're full of rock, and they put them in different places on the bridge and monitor the weight to see how the repair is doing.
I would not want to be the driver on that one.
Well,
I'm not testing it.
No, and then the guys then also will have to drive it too.
Yeah.
So they're static and dynamic testing to make sure that it's okay.
This is why we have to train monkeys to do just a little bit more than what they currently do.
I don't know. It could be kind of exciting to realize that you're doing that. I might be sitting on a parachute if that was me, but
it's only exciting. It's only historically meaningful if it crashes.
No,
something
don't
breaks.
Say that.
I'm about
don't
to say that's that. The only reason why anyone would talk about that. But no one's going, I remember that one driver who tested the West Seattle Bridge and literally nothing happened.
Well, but again, that's why they're, by the way, you say that's kind of funny. The city is not announcing a specific time on Sunday, the 18th, because they're worried a bunch of people are going to do what they normally do, which be line up really early and be like, I'm the first person across the bridge, like they did with I'm the last person across the 520 bridge before they opened up the news span. Yeah, I've never kind of understood that particular group of people, though I was one of the first to drive through the new tunnel. Of course, nobody was driving that day because that was a vicious snowstorm the day that that opened, but that's an entirely different story.
Okay, so good news.
Yeah, definitely.
Potentially, unless something happens, but right now, let those fingers crossed. Again, it's not even for me, mostly about the people who live on West Seattle. That's incredibly important to them. It's the impact that it has on everybody else.
It was regional, definitely. I mean, doctors, nurses, people who were providing health care for people in
Seattle. It impacts everyone.
Yeah, totally. So this is very good news, and I know it's been a pain.
A pain.
But yeah, people say that they feel exiled, stranded. But again, I mean,
people who live in West Seattle are a little insufferable. That is Chris Sullivan.
You said that, not me.
From Cairo News Radio. If you want to read a report on this and get more details, go to mynorthwest.com. Chris, thanks.
Anytime.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke the story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion. Jason, definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Well, obviously, the big breaking news today was the attorney general acknowledging that, yeah, he knew about and gave the green light for the Mar-a-Lago raid of former President Donald Trump's home. He says it was not taken lightly. He didn't take any questions, though, leaving a lot of questions still waiting for some answers. Joining me on the line is someone who hopes to find some answers, of course, former congressman, now CEO of Truth Social, Devin Nunes. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So take us through, just first of all, your big picture response to this five-ish minute press conference today. He just read a statement, didn't really learn too much beyond now confirming that he knew what happened.
I guess the first word that comes to me is bizarre. I guess that's the best description. You know, first of all, they said it was going to start. Then it was 30 minutes later. He read it off a teleprompter. He didn't really look very strong or confident. There's been, 3 days that went by of him not responding to anyone. There's been all sorts of rumors and innuendo out there that, you know, first he didn't know, and then all of a sudden he comes out and says he did know for sure. And I guess, you know, then also you always got to look at what the fake news is saying. And, you know, you and I discussed this last week at CPAC. And that is when the fake news is out there going out of their way to say the Biden and White House doesn't know anything. This is all news to them. They didn't even know that Merrick Garland was having a press conference today. Well, Jason, that means they probably did.
So, yeah, obviously.
I don't know. Just a lot of strangeness here. No questions were actually answered. I mean, he kind of threw it to Trump to release stuff. Mm-hmm. And I would say that look, you know, releasing what DOJ has put in writing is the last thing that I would do, being, you know, as a guy who had to investigate these dirty cops for so many years. During the Russia hoax, I just think that what we really need is names. Who did this? Who authorized it? Where's the emails? Where's all the back information? We don't need what DOJ is putting out there in front, because whatever they put out there in front is going to be designed for absolute maximum damage to whoever it is they're trying to target, right? So you really have to have an understanding of the entire process. And look, right now, this is very cloudy, but you have President Trump's side is saying that, they had them over there. They had no issues. They went through everything. This was in June. They had some nice discussions, and then they hadn't heard from them since June. And then to do this is just, there's no excuse for it. There were so many other steps, as you well know, that could have been taken.
Well, and their new reporting out today from the New York Times suggests that there was originally a subpoena and that the president's team complied with that subpoena. I can't quite tell if there were more documents that they're now going after from that same subpoena, or it's a new subpoena, or it could have been a new subpoena that they could have put out there to get the documents, whatever's in them. At the same time, we now have the speculation, and I think this is a valid guess, that this isn't really just about documents. This is really tied in some way to the January 6th investigation. What do you think?
Well, look, that's one of the concerns here, right? That they use this as the pretext to go in and grab information, any and everything. And I think most people know this, part of the law, which is, you know, if you go in to investigate one crime and you happen to come across other crimes, that it can be used in court, and can be used for an additional charge of some kind. And so, you know, that's the concern here is that, we still don't really know, but this it looks like it was over. It had to do with supposed classified information, which, as you know, I battled this for 5 years. Mm-hmm. The intelligence agencies, DOJ, refusing to show the American public what they called classified. And they always said, oh, this is going to damage national security. And every time I went through that process, you got to the end of the day, I would have to be out there. And this is for your listeners who don't know, I was the one who uncovered the Russia hoax from the House Intelligence Committee. Yep. And I would say, look, we need this document released. And every single time we'd have all the top people of DOJ and FBI, you know, oh, here the Republicans go. They're going to ruin national security. People are going to die. And then, of course, I spend 3, 4, 5 months with subpoenas, fighting it, having to go to, you know, having to have the Congress make motions. And then lo and behold, like, you know, just for example, the supposed secret Russian that was a super agent was some dude that was born in Russia, had worked for the Brookings Institute, living across the Potomac in Virginia, who was the Russia hoax deep throat source. I mean, and that's just one of many, many examples that it's always the same. Yeah. It's always the same. They say, oh, this is going to really hurt things. So if that's what they were there, they're there to look at classified documents that Trump supposedly had. And meanwhile, there's still mountains and mountains of Russia hoax documents that the president has declassified that we still haven't seen, I think is it just really smells.
Devin Nunes joining me on the line. He is he's the CEO of Truth Social, which is the social media platform that's owned by President Trump. Twitter today announced, we talked a little bit earlier on the show, that they're going to begin their heavy enforcement of the civic integrity policy, which they say is all about combating misleading information, false information. And it's certainly true that there is a lot of false information out there. But the concern, of course, is who decides what the false information is? And are we going to start censoring opinions that are made in good faith because it flies in the face of some things that Democrats want us to know? And, you know, those concerns are why sites like Truth Social are exploding.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say thank God we had Truth Social here, or else President Trump and the American people would have had no clue what was going on. It was the only way the president could actually reach millions and millions of people was through Truth Social. And so, you know, that's why I always like to say that I left Congress, I didn't need a new job, and President Trump surely didn't need a new company. We're doing this to give the American people their voice back, and thank God we had this. And Jason, I would draw your attention to, if you just go back and look over the last, it's been happening, for a while, for years now, but there's been a new purge, and they seem to be targeting kind of the Twitter user that has 100 to 300,000 followers that tend to be investigative reporters, that tend to be very, very witty, mm-hmm. But who are not really accepted by the fake news media. And look, I would say kind of the best example of that is you had a few weeks ago, Epoch Times, they tried to ban. Now, that one, there was enough of a fuss raised that they backed off of that one. But we've had several just kind of not with huge followings, but followings that have been purged and continue to be purged daily by Twitter. So I think this is going to come hard. It's going to come fast. And look, where I haven't been on Twitter for a long, long time. In fact, I just call it the Titter bot farm, sewer bot farm, you know?
Yeah.
But that's why we exist here at Truth Social, and that's why we continue to grow.
So just real quickly, we only have about a minute left. How do you view success when it comes to Truth Social? Because obviously you're not going to hit Twitter numbers in the first year. It's going to take a very long time. This is the long game. But how do you view this as a success?
Well, what we do is, you know, we're trying to reach out and provide users a great experience. And so we're about halfway through our feature set build out. So we're not at all trying to be Twitter. Like, that's the last thing we want to be. We don't have any interest in being a PR wire, you know, on the internet. you know, we're looking at Instagram and TikTok and what the American public and the consumer actually wants, and we're building that out. So if you look at our feed, if you look at what we have now, we're a little bit of Twitter, a little bit of Instagram. We have really good video. And then we're building out additional features to the platform over the course of the rest of the year. And then, of course, the question that everybody asks is, when are you going to be available on Android? You know, we are waiting for approval by Google. As soon as that happens, matter of fact, you can go pre-order the app, but it's ready to be released, but we're just waiting on Google. So, but you still can go to truesocial.com. I'll get a little plug in here, Jason.
Yep.
And you can sign up and get an account.
I recommend it. I'm on Truth Social. I hope people follow me. It's under the name Jason Rantz. It's really easy to follow me, and I'm doing everything there that I otherwise would be doing elsewhere. So I'm going to be everywhere, and that, of course, includes Truth Social, and I'm looking forward to it as it grows. Devin Nunes, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Thanks for having me, man.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle top radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Obviously, we've been talking this hour about the news of Merrick Garland, the attorney general's statement today to the press. He, of course, didn't take any questions because then he would be put on the spot. And in fairness, I understand some of the reason why you wouldn't answer some questions is because it is an ongoing investigation. And we've given the benefit of the doubt to police departments all the time. I'll give it to him in this case because it's true. You can't just say anything. You have to be very careful. Doesn't mean you can't answer any questions. And he very clearly can answer some questions. So I'm not going to give him a pass on that. But maybe he doesn't want to be put in a position where he's asked a question that he legitimately can't answer. But by saying I'm not going to answer it, you arouse some additional suspicions. He is, in fairness, in between a rock and a hard place. But this is of his own doing. But there's a lot of folks who rightly point to this and say, this is what you're spending your time on in D.C.? Really? First of all, you spent zero time, virtually zero time, going after the violent BLM radicals who were burning businesses to the ground and murdering people. The Antifa thugs that you pretended didn't exist. You didn't go after them once you could, once you took power. In fact, in many cases, charges were dropped against those domestic terrorists. So why is it that all of a sudden the DOJ isn't interested in throwing a whole bunch of resources to pick up some documents? And one of the people asking these questions is Jaime Puerta, who's the father of a kid who died from a fentanyl overdose. And he was on this morning with Fox News and said, hey, because this is not just tied to Merrick Garland. How about Secretary Mayorkas? Hey, dude, you understand that there's an open border, right? And while everyone in the Biden administration is apparently spending their time trying to figure what they can get the former president on so that they can indict him and then find him guilty so they can prevent him from ever running for office again, you do know you have a huge issue right now at the border, or the lack of border, we should say, that's not being taken care of. And as a result, all of these drugs are streaming into our communities, and it's taking the lives of other sons and daughters.
I believe there should be a death penalty for them. They know what they're peddling. They know that they're peddling fake pills, and it's killing children at an alarming rate. You know, we had 71,611 drug deaths related to fentanyl in 2021 alone. And for 2022, these numbers are going to get worse. Right now, myself and Andrea are standing for the hundreds of thousands of families who have no voice in this fight, that we are not being heard by our government, which is why we've sent this letter to President Biden asking him to please do something. You know, Mr. Mayorkas, if you could do something, instead of going to Mar-a-Lago and sending your FBI agents there, why aren't you kicking down the doors of all of these drug dealers here in the United States who are peddling this poison to our children and decimating it? We are getting massacred out here. These kids are dying every single day. We're suffering a 9/11 event every 2 weeks, and the government is not taking this seriously enough. So we're asking you to please... please do something. We're dying out here, and I'm tired of all these children dying. There's no reason for it whatsoever. It has to stop.
Now, obviously, when he mentioned Secretary Mayorkas, he's not in charge of sending any FBI agents. So let's just suss this out a little bit. Mayorkas, who is involved as the Secretary of Homeland Security, dude could right now, right this moment, put resources at the border. It's really not hard. It's really not hard at all. Go ahead and put some resources at the border. You can do that. CPB reports to you. You can throw some additional rhetoric out there to make it very clear that people shouldn't be coming here. Unfortunately, the policies of the Biden administration suggest otherwise, and people know that. But he could be doing something. Because what's happening at the border, thanks to folks like Alejandro Mayorkas, is that a whole bunch of drugs are streaming across, very easy to get into this country, particularly fentanyl, because a little goes a long way, and it's very easy to smuggle because of how tiny they are. You are keeping those borders open. The drugs are coming into our communities. They're being put into drugs laced with other things. You don't even, when you're, some guy is taking meth or heroin, doesn't realize that fentanyl is laced, and then bam, all of a sudden there's an overdose, a fatal one often. So there's that can be done. But you do have an FBI director. You do have U.S. attorneys across the country who could be doing more to work with local law enforcement to go after drug dealers. Unfortunately, in states like Washington or cities like Seattle, it's very easy to get away with drug dealing. It is. We have decriminalized drugs, which is effectively legalizing drugs, which means if you're caught with personal possession amounts on your person, you can't get even arrested or ticketed. You're not going to. Nothing will happen to you. So drug dealers are just holding on to a little bit less of the drugs. They are not keeping a whole bunch of it near them. It's nearby, I guess, but not on them or on the same block sometimes. It's at a different location. They just completely sell out and then go and restock. That's how it is happening. And the fact of the matter is, especially in cities like Seattle, we don't even have enough cops to go in there to try to find out who is dealing all the drugs. And without the threat of incarceration hanging over the heads of some of these addicts, you can't really push them into giving you some of the information that you need. Now, are arrests of drug dealers happening? Yes. Could there be more? Absolutely. Could something be done at the federal level? Yes. We can start taking this seriously. But again, it just feels like no one wants to. Because number one, it's too hard. Number two, you're the problem. You're the reason why this problem exists to begin with because of your policies. And number three, they really don't care. I honestly don't think they care in a lot of cases because they are blinded by their own ideology. If they weren't blinded by their ideology, they would see what their policies are doing. And thus, I do think that they would care. But they're such blind partisans. Such blind partisans that they're unlikely to see the damage that they're causing, certainly unlikely to see it enough to activate their consciences, to activate the any kind of soul searching as to whether or not they want to continue going down this path. It's killing people and they don't seem to care.
The Last Rants.
And with that, your semi-frequent reminder, I guess we do this once a quarter, to make sure you're not becoming a blind partisan, a partisan ideologue who doesn't see any damage or consequences of positions you take or policies you promote. Now, as a conservative, I obviously think that our policies are what's best for our communities, for our country. But we're not perfect. I'm certainly, that's a bad example. I'm perfect, but you're not perfect. Conservatives in general aren't perfect. We don't always have all the answers, and sometimes the answers that we provide aren't very good, aren't as effective as they ought to be. It is really easy when we are forwarding a position, a policy, whatever it is, and we're successful in getting it implemented, it is very easy to fall into the trap of not seeing the consequences. Because sometimes something good can come of your result. Of your policy, you actually got the result that you might have wanted in that world, whatever the issue was, let's say drug dealing, but then it creates a separate issue that you didn't even foresee coming. You have to keep an open mind when it comes to things like this, the unintended consequences. It happens a lot on the right, in certain circumstances, more right now on the left, but it can happen on the right. So you just have to make sure that you're not going to be a part of the problem. And it's really simple. It's just being literally aware. Just always check in with yourself and ask yourself if your bias in favor of a policy because it happens to align with your ideological position, our ideological positions. Just say to yourself, hey, am I truly looking at this honestly, holistically? Am I keeping an open mind? And am I listening to criticism? The left doesn't like to listen to criticism, which is why their policies never develop, never evolve. Quite the opposite. We need to do better at listening to criticism and then taking it from there. Sometimes the criticism is wholly, and I mean wholly, ludicrous. Okay, we don't have to listen to that. But sometimes you do have to check in with yourself to say, am I being honest here? Am I being fair here? And I think that deserves a reminder every once in a while, or at least once a quarter. And that's the last rants.